Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
I'm happy to welcome Rob Boston, senior editor at Americans United for the Separation of Church and State and editor of Church and State. Welcome to Mindshift Podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
I've been following your work for a while on the AU website, and I chased you down because I thought, okay, here's a kindred spirit. I've been doing a lot of research and writing on the Christian right, dominion theology, all the evangelicals that are in politics right now today. So what led you to have an interest in that movement as well?
Well, that actually springs from my interest in separation of church and state just generally. I've worked at Americans United for quite a long time, for 33 years. And my interest in that issue springs from, reading of history. I think any fair reading of history leads one to conclude that when religion and government are combined, you don't get good results. Usually it's oppression, violence, persecution, and war, and so on. Or, you know, in some modern states, you have a sort of a devitalized, house-trained state church, but I don't think most people would want that either. Mm-hmm. So the reading of history really led me to be very interested in wanting to advocate for separation of church and state. And when I started looking a little bit into the groups and individuals who were opposed to the separation of church and state, of course, you know, you run into various television evangelists and religious right activists and others, but then I found out about these Reconstructionists, you know, Christian Reconstructionists. Way back in the late 80s, someone put me onto them. And at first I thought, oh, this can't be serious. You know, people actually arguing overtly for theocracy.
Mm-hmm.
But sure enough, the more I looked, the closer it became that is exactly what they wanted to do.
So you came at it from the point of view that you were for separation of church and state. And here you'd suddenly run into all these groups that are arguing the exact opposite, which of course we see in so many evangelical circles. Guys like David Barton of Wall Builders, he's made a whole career out of going nationwide, and he's all over Washington, D.C., where you're headquartered as well, teaching classes on the myths of Christian nationalism, or as he would see it, that's the forgotten history, that America was founded as a Christian nation, the founders never intended for a separation of church and state, and all the rest of it.
Yes, perhaps I was a little naive, but back in the late 80s when I was, you know, in my 20s, I was shocked to learn that there were people who attacked the idea of separation of church and state. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, it just seemed like such a fundamental American principle, so important, and the type of thing that you could look at and you'd see the benefits in our society. How could anyone be against that? It was like being against free speech, you know, freedom of the press. Yet we had these people who definitely felt that way. And with the Reconstructionists, it's interesting. Way back in 1988, the time I was the assistant editor of Church and State magazine. Now I'm the editor, but for a number of years I was the assistant editor. And the editor at the time was a guy named Joe Kahn. And he said to me that he'd been wanting for someone to write a story about these Reconstructionists and really kind of expose them and dig into their beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So I just started reading their books and acquired a number of volumes by Lucius John Rush Dooney and Gary North, and actually put together a pretty impressive library that I still have of some of the major Reconstructionist writings. And that article, which was in Church and State in September 1988, was, as far as I know, the first expose of that movement in a secular publication.
Mm-hmm. So what was so shocking about these Reconstructionists when you came across them way back in the mid-late 80s that was so surprising to your point of view?
Where to start? I mean, the views were so extreme. I just remember reading this one book by Rush Dooney, and he had a list of all the people who would merit the death penalty once the Reconstructionists had taken over society and reconstructed it.
Mm-hmm.
And as I read the list, I thought, there's not going to be anybody left.
Who's left? Only them, maybe.
Yeah, maybe them, and not even themselves, because as you know, they argue among themselves about these meetings. But nevertheless,
that's true.
Some of the sanctions, the death penalty sanctions they wanted to apply, were for very vague crimes, so to speak. For instance, unchastity. I mean, if you're going to start executing people for being...
We're all in trouble.
Unchaste. We're finished. Yeah, exactly.
That's a broad net. You could snare a lot of people in that. Well, and that's the thing, is a lot of people get caught up in the more extreme elements of Christian Reconstructionism. Like you say, I remember talking to Julie Ingersoll. I'm sure you're familiar with her work. She's done a lot of writing on Christian Reconstructionism. And she said that don't get sidetracked. Don't get into the weeds when you start getting into the more extreme. What's more concerning is how they have infiltrated, their beliefs have infiltrated the Christian right. That's, you know, she argues it's more concerning because what we're seeing in the Trump administration, okay, these guys may not be card-carrying Reconstructionists per se, but they have been influenced by guys like Rush Dooney, haven't they?
Yeah, some, a lot of people will point to Rush Dooney and say, of course, you know, you're talking about a figure who seems very extreme and somebody who obviously wasn't very well known. If you think about religious right leaders in America, most people would name Jerry Falwell, Dr. James Dobson, Tony Perkins, Pat Robertson. Rush Dooney's name would not automatically, you know, spring out. This is a guy whose writings provided a sort of philosophical framework, I think, for a lot of the activism of what we're now calling Christian nationalists. A lot of people are using that term instead of religious right, but basically the same thing. You're talking about people who reject the separation of church and state and believe that their particular version of fundamentalist Christianity should reign supreme. I mean, for a long time, the view among a lot of fundamentalists was that they really were, they weren't about worldly things. Politics wasn't their thing. They were just kind of waiting for Jesus to come back and they could go up to heaven and everything would be just great. This idea that you had an obligation and a duty to try to reform society right now at the time you're living, almost a very Puritan idea, springs from the writings and the teachings of Rush Dooney and Gary North and others.
And we know they were reading his books. There's that famous story. I think it was the rally in Dallas, Texas in 1980, where Ronald Reagan was then a candidate for president. Gary North was sitting there, Rush Dooney's son-in-law, and he said, he was talking to someone next to him and said, you know, why isn't Rush Dooney speaking at this thing? And the guy said, look, I don't know, but we're all reading his books, but we hide him under the bed, you know? So they didn't want to admit, even back in 1980, they were reading Institutes of Biblical Law and some of these other books, but yet, as you say, he's kind of the architect in many ways of the religious right, it seems.
Yes, absolutely. And I can certainly understand why they kept him at arm's length. I mean, if you read those books, not only do you see that what we were talking about earlier with the death penalty and so on, but you just find a lot of other extreme ideas, you know, subjugation of women, attacks on the LGBTQ community. I was surprised in one of Rush Dooney's books, he denied the Holocaust. I mean, they're just really extreme views in these books.
Pro-slavery.
Yeah, pro-slavery. They're not going to want to put a guy like that front and center, but certainly will draw from him and use his justifications to become the rationale for their political involvement.
Well, and as you say, this issue of the separation of church and state, in a way, it's kind of central to our whole discussion, isn't it? Because if you can maintain that separation, then you're somewhat more safe from extremists like Rush Dooney and some of the others. Can you describe the work of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State? What does your organization do? What is it about?
Yes, exactly. Well, the great thing about Americans United is we have this very singular focus, separation of church and state. There are a lot of civil liberties out there. They're all very important. There are groups defending them. But we're focusing strictly on separation of church and state. And it's our belief that that principle protects religious and philosophical freedom. And the reason I say that is because our opponents often attack us and say, well, you're just a bunch of atheists, or you want non-religion to be the dominant viewpoint. You want the government to embrace non-belief. And that's really not what we're about. Mm-hmm. Our membership runs the gamut from very devout believers and then all the way to atheists. I mean, we're happy to have that range of support, Christians and non-Christians and folks who are advocating for this principle. But the idea is that if the government is neutral on religion, and neutrality is not hostility. Let's be clear about that. The government's neutral on religion. That allows the decision about what religion to be involved with, if any, how to be involved with it, how to raise your children in a faith if you so choose, and which ones to support with your money. It leaves all of those decisions in the hands of the individual, not the state.
Well, you say it's actually better for religious liberty to maintain the separation. I was reading on your website where you actually say, no, it's a better thing in general. Because, of course, this is loaded language, isn't it? When you hear the words religious liberty, religious freedom from the evangelical, the dominionist side, they mean something entirely different than what most people might think. Oh, that means you can be a Buddhist or a Muslim or an atheist or a Christian, or and you won't get hassled by the state or other religions. But yet they're saying, no, it's really about protecting the rights of Christians to practice Christianity, to, you know, make it the prime religion in America. and to even discriminate against other people who disagree with us.
Yes, it's unfortunate if you look at what the Christian nationalists say about religious freedom. Mm-hmm. They've really turned that concept on its head. I think my reading from the views of the framers and the founding fathers, it's very clear that they had an expansive interpretation of religious freedom. You know, Thomas Jefferson once spoke very powerfully about the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which was a precursor to the First Amendment, protecting the Jew and the Gentile and the Hindu, the Mahometan, you know, by which he meant them, and the infidel of every denomination. So the view that they held was certainly not one that just Christians were protected. I think that the most compelling piece of evidence to debunk a claim like that is the text of the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights itself. Mm-hmm. It does not recognize Christianity in any way. It doesn't preference it. It doesn't even mention it. The words Christianity, Jesus Christ, or God are not found anywhere in our Constitution. It's a secular document, and that was done that way for a reason.
Specifically, yeah, most of them were deists, if they were anything. I mean, sure, there were devout Christians among our founding fathers, and of course, that's where David Barton has made a career, hasn't he, of going around producing copious quotes, some of them unsubstantiated, as we now know, to prove, in air quotes, that not only were they all superlative evangelicals like today, and that they wanted a Christian America. So we have to live out that mandate that really is not even true at all historically.
Right. The Christian nation myth is what creationism is to science. It is a historical version of creationism. The fundamentalists, the evangelicals, they didn't like the science of evolution. They didn't like where that led. They didn't like what it implied. They didn't like what it says. So they just sort of created this new so-called science, and I put that in air quotes because it's not a science, called creationism, to support their views and attack evolution and argue against all available evidence that the earth, far from being ancient, is only 6,000 years old.
Right.
And it's on its face absurd. Similarly, the historical claims of the Christian nationists simply cannot be supported. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence for them. And it's interesting that rather than look at the source document, the Constitution, they will point to other documents instead that either don't say what they think they say or just aren't relevant. I always find it amusing that they point to the Declaration of Independence, which is a very important document, obviously, in our history, a powerful statement of our desire to be a free nation. But it's not a governance document. It wasn't designed to establish a government. It says nothing about how a government shall be ordered. Mm-hmm. And the references in it to God are deistic. They're not even Christian. Yeah. So when they point to that, they're actually undercutting their own argument. But of course, they're too dense, just don't care. And they keep promoting that idea.
And as we say, David Barton, he's hugely popular. Guys like him have made a career out of selling books. And a lot of his stuff ends up in Christian homeschool curriculum. He seems to be everywhere. He's on Kenneth Copeland's Believer's Voice of Victory talking about the Ten Commandments and voting. And then he's on stage with somebody, and then he's in the halls of Congress, and then he's promoting this and promoting. I mean, and yet he's been thoroughly debunked. His book, The Jefferson Lies, was pulled from the shelves by its publisher, and yet it doesn't seem to have affected his career at all.
Yes, it's very unfortunate. I have been debunking David Barton's nonsense since 1993. That was the year I wrote the first article, and I had a point-by-point refutation of everything he got wrong. And his book, which at that time was called The Myth of Separation, he since retitled it and now calls it Original Intent. But nevertheless, just a point-by-point refutation. And I'm not a professional historian. So I stood on the shoulders of other people who really were, like the late Robert Alley, who was a professor at the University of Richmond, who did a really great job debunking David Barton. And there were others, people with legitimate, you know, academic degrees, unlike Barton, PhDs. And that's still happening. When The Jefferson Lies was pulled from publication, one of the reasons that happened is that a professor named Warren Throckmorton had really just pointed out all the errors in the book. And I mean, these were not just matters of interpretation, flat out errors. And he compiled his own book to point those out. And there are others been doing that too. But the man, Barton, it's like he's covered in Teflon. It doesn't stick. And that is because he's not a real historian. He is a pseudo historian. And he is, as I mentioned earlier, the equivalent of a creationist, but for history. Mm-hmm. And the people who believe his story that he's peddling don't care about facts. They don't care about accuracy. They care about hearing a comforting myth instead. And David Barton's myth tells them that there was this great, wonderful, glorious Christian nation, mm-hmm. and it was stolen from us by those nasty secularists and atheists or feminists or gay people or whoever they want to demonize, stole this thing from us, and we're going to get it back. So it has a political dimension to it as well. It inspires people, activates them to get involved in very conservative politics, which is really the end game for a lot of these folks.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly right. I was just going to say something similar myself, that I think what motivates these guys is they don't agree with the sort of post-millennial view of guys like Rush Dooney. They're more pre-millennialist, but what does motivate them is the belief in this covenant theology, as you say. So if God's hand of blessing has been withdrawn from America because of the sins, we've allowed abortion, we've allowed homosexuality, same-sex marriage, pornography, all these evils, we can get that back, though, as you say, by that. Now it's a case of politicizing the thing because they're saying we can turn this ship around and get back in God's good graces, stave off the judgment as long as we possibly can before the end of the world. So that seems to be a lot of their motivation.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I also think that some of it is kind of a sea change in fundamentalist / evangelical thinking that occurred at some point along the line. I couldn't pinpoint exactly when, but I mean, the idea used to be that you were going to look out for yourself, your family, and your loved one. And you were going to live whatever you determined to be a morally upright life. And you'd go to heaven. That would be your reward at the end when you died. And if your neighbor, having been exposed to biblical truth, which at some point you would assume he or she was, chose to reject it, well, that was going to be on them. You know, you made the effort that they were going to go to hell, and that's just the way it was.
Yeah.
Not your problem.
You did your part.
You were part of the Great Commission, you know?
Yeah.
You don't get to persuade everybody.
Your conscience is clear, yeah.
Yeah. Somewhere along the line, they began to adopt this point of view that if you can't persuade people, it's morally legitimate to force them and try to use the power of the state to force them. And that's kind of what they've been doing for the past, you know, 40 or 50 years.
I think that's exactly right. What the motivation is that they've kind of said, well, all these Supreme Court rulings have gone against us. You know, they've removed God from the schools. That's a familiar line, isn't it? They've kicked him out of the classroom. They've kicked him out of the public sector. Therefore, it's no longer about conversionism and changing the world one person at a time through salvation and then converting to Christianity. Now they're thinking, wait a minute, we need to get involved in politics and actually legislate this stuff. I mean, look at the recent laws that have come out trying to ban abortion in multiple states, draconian laws, the marriage covenant laws that Mike Huckabee and some others were trying to instill a few years ago, making it harder to get married and making it much harder to get divorced. So they're actually trying to legislate these things in order to make these changes now.
Absolutely. And also, too, I think there's another dimension of this is the idea that God just doesn't judge individuals, which, you know, standard Christian theology is you die, you face judgment, and you go to the, you know, the nice place or the not so nice place. Uh-huh. But somewhere along the line, again, I couldn't pinpoint this because I'm not a theologian or a historian of theology, but somewhere along the line, the idea that nations as entities themselves would be collectively judged was adopted by these folks. And somehow, you know, the old thinking was, well, what your neighbor's doing, they're living in sin, they're not living a godly life. Well, you know, not my business. Now suddenly what your neighbor is doing is your business because it's causing your entire nation to face the wrath of this very angry God. Mm-hmm. Now, that's probably not a new idea. I mean, I know there are sermons from after Puritans. The adoption. Yeah, Puritans. And after the adoption of the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights, there were sermons by extremely conservative pastors who were furious that the Constitution did not establish Christianity as an official religion and held that God would punish us for that. So that idea of corporate punishment of a nation is not new, but it suddenly started to just get a lot more currency with the rise of the religious right as a political movement in the late 70s and early 80s.
I think you're right. They tap back into that Puritan covenant theology. You can go all the way back to John Winthrop in 1630. He's preaching a sermon either in Southampton, England, or something maybe on the ship after they left the harbor to sail for Massachusetts. And he was the one who came up with that trope of we're going to be the city on the hill and the eyes of the world are upon us and we're a covenant nation. They saw themselves as a new Israel. And yeah, God makes covenants with individuals as well as nations. And so that thinking is still very much around today.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's been much to our detriment, honestly. Mm. And a lot of it, I think, does inform some of these more far-flung theologies that we're seeing arise in the far right these days.
So going back to this issue of anti-LGBTQ legislation and all the rest of it, you've been writing a lot of articles recently on this recent Supreme Court ruling. Now, that was a big shock to conservatives because we know, of course, you can say, okay, Rush Dooney wanted the death penalty for homosexuals. Most evangelicals are not going to be that extreme, although you do see the independent fundamentalist Baptists and people like Westboro Baptists. They're on the far, far, far fundamentalist right. Can you comment on this ruling? It actually upheld an earlier ruling from 1964 about discrimination against, among other things, race, religion, national origin, and gender.
Yes.
That was a big shock, wasn't it? We are just going to take a very short break here in my conversation with Rob Boston, who is the senior editor of Church and State magazine. And he also is a writer for AU.org, which is the Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. So if you want to read more of his writings on these important topics, this issue of the separation of church and state and why that matters, you need to look up some of Rob's stuff on the AU website. And speaking of this important topic of maintaining a separation between church and state and Christian nationalism, which we're going to get back into in just a minute, I've got a couple of really good episodes coming up. First of all, I had a good chat the other day with Angela Danker. She is the author of the book that's just come out not long ago called Red State Christians: Understanding the Voters Who Elected Donald Trump. And this is really interesting because Angela, although she is a journalist, an author, and a speaker, she's also a Lutheran pastor, and she offers a very unique sort of pastoral insight as she traveled all over the country, of course, before all the COVID lockdowns and everything, interviewing people who voted for Donald Trump, Christians in many cases. And she offers a really unique perspective, and hopefully her insights will maybe open up some of the dialogue in our deeply polarized country that we have in the United States. I've also got a conversation scheduled with Catherine Stewart, who was on the show not long ago. She is, of course, the author of the book, The Power Worshippers, but I've been working my way through an earlier book that she wrote called The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. And we are going to be focusing on that episode on her book, The Good News Club. So look out for that episode with Catherine Stewart coming up, as well as the one with Angela. I think I'm going to release that as a bonus episode. And then the next scheduled episode coming up in a couple of weeks, I've got Julie Ann Smith. She's the blogger from the Spiritual Sounding Board website, and she writes a lot of stuff on spiritual abuse, biblical patriarchy, the Quiverful movement, homeschooling, and all of that does relate to some of the stuff that we talked about a few weeks back with Dr. Milton Gaither, this issue of Christian homeschooling, biblical patriarchy, and how a lot of people within that movement see that as their mandate for taking dominion by having as many children as they possibly can in a very toxic and oftentimes abusive environment. And Julianne comes out of that herself. So if you want to do some reading, a little bit of pre-research, read some of Julianne's articles on the Spiritual Sounding Board website. I just wanted to say too, real quickly, before we get back into the chat with Rob, that we are nearly finished with my 5-week course on exploring the origins of the Christian right and dominion theology. In fact, this Sunday coming up on the 5th of July, that is actually our last session. It's hard to believe it's been 5 weeks already. We're going to finish up by talking about Christian nationalism and why people should be concerned, similar to what Rob and I are talking about here, why you should care. And so I'm actually going to run this course again. If you're interested, this has been a phenomenal course. I've had a lot of really good feedback from the people we've had on it. We've had about 6 or 7 people take the course, and it's actually ended up being, I thought it was going to be 1-hour sessions. It's been more like 2 to 2.5 hour sessions as we've gotten into it, and people are like, oh my God, I didn't realize the extent of this stuff. We talked about Rush Dooney, Christian Reconstructionism, Dominion Theology, Christian homeschooling, and how all these seemingly sort of disparate threads tie together in this whole thing. So if that sounds like something that you're interested in learning about, it's absolutely a fascinating and frankly chilling kind of a concept and a topic. Let me know, because we will run this course again. It'll be a 5-week course, and the cost is $100, which is pretty cheap considering you get a good 2 to 2.5 hour session every Sunday night for a good 5 weeks. So let me know if you want to take that course and I'll run it again. I just wanted to say, too, thank you to all the people that supported the show on Patreon. If you want to be a part of that, you get access to early releases of episodes as they drop on Wednesdays. You also get to be a part of our closed Mindshift Podcast Facebook group, and that gets you access to our monthly Mindshift Zoom calls, which we just had, in fact, the other day with David from the Graceful Atheist podcast. That was an absolutely great conversation. And in fact, I'm going to be uploading that on my Mindshift Podcast Facebook page here at some point, maybe in the next week or so. So you can head over there. You can also watch last month's conversation with Laura Anderson, which was really good. And I'm working on getting Kristen Dumay, who was on the show not long ago, coming in hopefully in July to be our guest. I've also got Julianne Smith, who's going to be coming up in a few weeks. She's going to be our guest in August. So some fantastic guests dropping into our monthly Mindshift Zoom call. So anyway, let's get back into the chat with Rob Boston as we continue taking a look at this issue of the separation of church and state, why that's important. And if you remember where we stopped the conversation before the break, I had just asked him about this new Supreme Court ruling that's just come out a few weeks ago on this issue of LGBTQ rights and why that's important. So let's hear what Rob has to say.
It was a shock. A lot of us were surprised because the Supreme Court is pretty conservative these days. And really, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding of this case is that it did hinge on how you would define gender. When the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was written, it did include a provision saying that there can be no discrimination on the basis of gender, as well as race and religion and national origin. Does gender include folks who are LGBTQ? That was kind of the question. Majority that the court held that it does. Now, the interesting thing about this case is the majority might have left a bit of a loophole. And we'll see how that shakes out. But they left open the door for the idea that if an individual has a strongly grounded religious objection to LGBTQ rights, based in their religious belief, that they may be entitled to some type of an exemption. They may not have to serve members of the LGBTQ community in their business. And we're actually seeing a number of cases like that already in the courts, where some states prior to the Supreme Court's ruling, some states and localities had laws on the books that extended protections to members of the LGBTQ community. And some business owners who had, you know, for-profit secular businesses, not religious entities, were fighting against that, saying, well, I have a personal religious objection to serving these people, and I'm not going to do it, and I have the religious right not to do it. And if that is allowed to stand, I mean, that's a pretty big loophole in an otherwise solid law that should protect people from discrimination.
Well, we see like the Masterpiece Cake Shop and Kim Davis, the clerk from Kentucky, who refused to sign a marriage license for a same-sex couple wedding. And they become celebrities among the Christian right, these guys. But then their cases got picked up, I believe, by the Alliance Defending Freedom, the ADF, which is a massive Christian powerhouse legal defense arm. And they're the ones fighting against in the courts all these sorts of cases, aren't they?
Yes. The Alliance Defending Freedom is a large organization. The budget is something like $50 million a year. They bring a lot of these cases into the courts. Now, there are other groups doing the same thing, but they're by far the biggest and the most powerful. And I have to say, I mean, although I disagree with what they're doing, they're pretty clever about the cases they bring. They don't bring cases that they know they're going to lose, like some of these organizations do. They find, you know, plaintiffs that to at first glance might seem sympathetic. So they're very clever in the way that they bring these cases. But their overall approach and their belief system is pretty extreme. They had something on their website a couple of years ago. They've since taken it down, probably because I kept writing about it, where they forthrightly stated on their website that their goal was to get back to the kind of robust Christianity that we had in the 4th and 5th centuries. So, wow. You know, okay. They'll go Byzantine on us. That's their view.
Yeah, it's not just enough to go medieval on people. We're gonna go all the way back to the Council of, but that's Chalcedon. You know, that's where Rush Dooney was living. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, and then you've got connections. Okay, Michael Ferris, he's with the ADF now, one of their attorneys, if not their lead attorney. But he, of course, founded the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, Patrick Henry College. He had known associations with guys like Rush Dooney, the Coalition on Revival. So Doug Phillips and all these other people, Chris Klicka, they were all part of the HSLDA. So these people, you've got to know who they are, I think. And they pop up all over the place, and you go, okay, I see that guy or this woman. She's over here. He's over there. And that's how you can start making those connections, I think.
Right, exactly. And another point to remember is that some of these folks had political ambitions. I mean, Mike Ferris ran for lieutenant governor of Virginia. Now he lost, but there have been some of these folks that have really tried to get out there and run for office and have a direct impact on policy that way. Now, of course, make no mistake, everybody has the right to run for office.
Sure.
But people need to be aware of the views of these individuals and understand what exactly it is they're trying to do. Because in my experience, when they're running for office, they tend to downplay some of these more extreme views and you know, don't necessarily bring up the fact that they have had ties to organizations that want to execute gatekeeping.
Exactly. You've just got to know. I mean, talking about people that are in the Trump administration right now, that's what Catherine Stewart, she defines it as, it's an interconnected web of organizations and people like Ralph Drollinger, Capital Ministries. Okay, Lance Wallnau, he's a known Seven Mountains Mandate Dominionist guy. Not only does he preach and teach all over the place, but he's appearing in Capitol Hill, teaching people on seven, you know, politicians on the Seven Mountains Mandate. You've got the Family Research Council, the Family, Focus on the Family. I mean, these are massive powerhouse organizations. What is their impact so far that you see on this, the Trump administration?
Well, I think it's been significant. Now, obviously, when we look at Trump himself, this is a man that obviously is illiterate about the fundamentals of Christianity, doesn't know what's in the Bible, and probably who knows if he even has a personal faith himself. But it doesn't matter because he's given these people what they want. And when it came to staffing some of these very important positions in the federal government, I don't think he personally was approving any of these appointments, but he just turned it over to people who began pulling from these very extreme organizations. I mean, we do know that a couple of cases, individuals have left religious right legal groups and stepped right into the administration. And they're the ones who are rewriting regulations and shaping executive orders. Remember, just about everything that Trump has done has not been through the regular mechanism of governing. It's not because he's signing legislation. And right now, we're at a point where Democrats hold the House, Republicans hold the Senate, and except for judges, which they're pushing right through the Senate at an alarming rate, legislation is not being passed because of the stalemate. So instead, this is an administration that's been governing through regulatory changes at the federal level and issuing executive orders. And I think a lot of those are being influenced and shaped by these extreme Christian nationalist types who are using the levers of government to put forth their extremely theocratic viewpoint.
Look at one of the first statements that Trump made when he was finally installed as president in early 2017 in a Rose Garden speech. He said, "I'm going to totally destroy the Johnson Amendment." So that, you know, he's got to immediately pay back his evangelical base that helped get him into office. And yet you see, as we're recording this just a day or so ago, there was a Trump rally in Phoenix, Arizona at Dream City Church, at a church where hosted by Turning Point USA, which is Charlie Kirk's organization, a total Christian nationalist organization, at a church where Trump is speaking. To me, that's a clear violation of the Johnson Amendment from top to bottom. But yet nothing's going to happen.
Yeah, that's what's so frustrating about a lot of this is some of these executive orders haven't really done anything. I mean, the Johnson Amendment, which is a provision that says that nonprofit entities in the United States may not, if they're tax exempt, may not intervene in elections by endorsing or opposing candidates. And that applies to secular and religious groups across the board. And Trump can't overturn that with an executive order. That's an act of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be repealed by a congressional vote, which has not happened. So he put out this really meaningless executive order, but it wasn't meaningless in one respect. The point was to create the impression that they had done this, that they had changed the law in this profound and fundamental way. And that leads to a lot of churches and a lot of pastors saying, well, we don't have to abide by this anymore. We're going to push the envelope. And quite frankly, the Internal Revenue Service, which is in charge of policing and enforcing this particular provision, is understaffed and overwhelmed and hasn't been giving it any priority. Throughout the 1990s and early 2000s at Americans United, we reported many, many cases of blatant violations of the Johnson Amendment by houses of worship. And to be fair, it wasn't just always conservatives. There were liberal-leaning organizations that often stepped over the line as well. We reported them all. There was a little bit of enforcement in the early 90s, and then they just backed off, and we haven't seen anything significant since then. So creating the impression that it's okay to do this is leading a lot of these pastors to just jump right into partisan politics in ways that just aren't legal.
Well, they know they're not going to be persecuted and on any level or prosecuted. It's funny because you go back to Jerry Falwell Sr. I was reading about the formation of the Moral Majority in 1979. And when they got that started in finally 1980s, they were really concerned about skirting the laws. So they would hand out flyers in the church's parking lot. They couldn't do it inside the building. You know, so they were real cognizant of the legal, I guess, exposure at that time in the early 80s that pastors and churches were putting themselves into. But now Family Research Council can hold an event in a church and talk about voters, voter guides, on all the, and training up pastors to teach their congregants to get involved in the political process. That's the clearest violation of the Johnson Amendment, it seems to me. And yet they know they're totally protected.
Yes, and I've seen a lot of these voter guides over the years, and I'll tell you, you'd have to be pretty dense not to know who they're telling you to vote for. I mean, these voter guides, well, they're so stacked, they're so biased. They make the preferred candidate look like, you know, Christ himself.
He's a saint, of course, or she's a saint.
Yes, his or her opponent is Satan. They'll selectively distort positions of candidates or just lie, you know, whatever's easier to do, sure. and put this information out. So the guides themselves are very problematic, but you're right. They're just passing them out. They put them into church bulletins sometimes.
Yeah.
They don't even bother. I mean, yeah, you're right. They used to at least try to pretend they were following the law by doing it offsite. Now they just go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
And it's a real problem. But again, until we get some sort of enforcement from the IRS on this, we're just not making the headway that we'd like to.
You mentioned the word Christian nationalism. Can you define that? How do you see it? Because there's a lot of definitions out there. I've just finished listening to Sam Perry and Andrew Whitehead's book, Taking America Back for God, which is really all about the statistical side of Christian nationalism. And they, of course, have a definition for it. What are your thoughts on Christian nationalism?
It's an interesting term because over the years, a lot of us have struggled with how to define the theocrats among us. Religious right, Christian right, those were terms that were used a lot over the years. But people felt that they weren't quite right from a sort of a marketing perspective. You know, people think about, in this country, people hear the word religious or Christian, and they get a general positive thought. I mean, most people do. They think, oh, well, religion's good. I like Christianity. That's a good thing. Right, exactly. And a lot of people are conservative. So when they hear the word right, that resonates with them.
Happy
so
days.
We sort of, struggled with terminology. Christian nationalism, to me, is a belief that, first of all, God, Christianity, fundamentalist Christianity, Bible-based Christianity, however you want to call it, that's the favored Christian perspective of the deity himself, and of course he is a man, and that it is not only a good idea but necessary to merge that with government power in the hopes of officially creating some kind of a Christian state. Now, when I say Christian state, understand we're not talking here about the Methodist or the United Church of Christ or the Lutherans or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about extreme fundamentalist, extremely conservative Christianity that has merged its faith with politics. That's what the Christian nationalists seek. And there are a lot of other facets to it. The idea that we're God's favorite nation, that's a key view of Christian nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people hold that. God holds a belief and a special place in his heart for the United States and the people of the United States, his favorite country. And of course, the belief, which we've discussed earlier, that we were intended and founded to be an officially Christian nation. And that was undermined by the Supreme Court or the liberals or the secularists or whoever they're blaming it on. That's another key element of it. So you kind of put all that together and you're looking at a fairly toxic religio-political brew, as I would say.
Something that Perry and Whitehead say, it's more of a framework because there's a lot of streams and iterations within it, isn't there? It's not a monolithic one sort of set of beliefs that everyone adheres to. There's a lot of even disagreements within the Dominionist and, like you say, you can go way extreme. You can go Reconstructionist. You can go charismatic, the Seven Mountains guys. They disagree amongst themselves. But I think you're right. There's that belief that America was a Christian nation and that we should be again at some point in the future. So we've got to work together to get to whatever that aim or goal is. Well, speaking of Christian nationalism, another recent event that took place, clearing of the protesters in Washington, D.C. by the police, rubber bullets and tear gas and flashbang grenades and all the rest of it. Trump comes out with a Bible in front of an Episcopal church. Is that a clear demonstration of this whole Christian nationalism thing? What's your thoughts on that stunt?
That incident was just so bizarre.
Very surreal.
Still not sure what they were thinking when they decided to do that. I mean, there have been protests in Washington, D.C. for several days about people speaking out against the murder of black folks and police brutality. Mm-hmm. And they were around the White House. Now, there's an area near the White House that's often used for these types of protests, Lafayette Square. It's nothing new. People protest mm-hmm. there all the time. And I guess the president just got it into his head that people were getting the idea that he was afraid to emerge or that he was somehow intimidated by these protesters. So he wanted to go outside the White House and walk around and show that he wasn't afraid. And I guess they just decided, right, he'd been hiding in a bunker. Yeah. They decided that he would just walk down to this church. Now, he hadn't been invited to be there. No member of the clergy there wanted him there. The church had earlier in the day, some vandal had set a fire there that was quickly mm-hmm. put out. So there had been some damage, but you know, it wasn't like he was there to inspect the damage or anything. No one even knew he was going to be there. So he goes there and holds up this Bible. It looked like it was upside down to me yeah. in front of the church. The pictures are taken, and then he goes back. And of course, in order to do this, they had to clear all those protesters from Lafayette Square, which they mm-hmm. did with chemical agents and rubber bullets.
Yeah, it was illegal.
And it hit a couple of members of the clergy, actually, mm-hmm. who were protesting. So,
ironically,
it didn't actually go over very well. It's interesting. There's been some data about that, about fallout from that. And, you know, it's always difficult to know what causes polls to move one way or another. But even among evangelicals, self-identified white evangelicals, which is President Trump's base, there was a dip in support. Not a huge drop, but a little dip after that incident. So maybe even some of them thought that that went a little bit too far. I don't know. I mean, I expect that. That will go back up. I don't think there's going to be any serious erosion in that part of his base, but at least for a little while, some of them maybe had second thoughts.
Reports of his death are greatly exaggerated, as they say. Yeah, every exactly. time they talk about the evangelical base cracking underneath Trump, it never wavers, really, does it? No matter what he does, there might be dips, as you say. You know, it's a fascinating case study, I think, as I saw the whole incident, because I'm coming at it as an ex-evangelical. I studied Bible and theology. I taught that all for years, you know, so I interpreted it as watching the reactions. And like you say, the liberal, the more Episcopalian, they condemned it outright. She yes. ripped him up one side and down the other. But then there was a lot of conservative evangelicals. They said, oh, he's wearing the armor of God. He's doing a Joshua walk around Jericho. You know, it's like, what are you talking about? You know?
Yeah, the mental gymnastics that they've had to do, hold this man up as some kind of great Christian leader when he's clearly illiterate. You know, this is member Mr. 2 Corinthians.
yeah. When he doesn't asked need to ask for forgiveness.
Right, yeah. When asked to name his favorite Bible verse, made one up. You know, I mean, it's hopeless.
I don't like to get into specifics, he said.
it's hopeless. Now, but this is not new. We knew this from even before the election. Yeah. The signs were all there. But they have just excused one thing after another. And what's really the height of hypocrisy to my mind is, if you took mm-hmm. even a third of the or a fourth of the things that this guy has done, transferred them to a Democratic president, the evangelicals, the conservative evangelicals in this country would be going absolutely crazy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does these things, and they just
daily.
They just don't care. They just because he's giving them the judges and so many other policy things mm-hmm. through those regulatory changes and executive orders that I've talked about. There,
he's delivering
for them, so they're going to overlook all of his transgression.
This is it. They've got a strong man in the office. He's that Cyrus figure or David or whatever biblical character they want to assign to him. Despite his flaws, he's still delivering, and God can use a flawed man even. That's another classic line. God used, you know, Cyrus, and God used David, even though he was a murderer and an adulterer and blah, blah, blah.
I used to worry about, you know, we were going to have a true religious zealot get elected, you know, in the office. Mm. Somebody like Mike Pence, you know, or what
have you. Yeah, he's a true blue fundamentalist.
Yeah, true believer, you know, get in there and just, oh, you know, who knows? It's going to be like The Handmaid's Tale. Mm-hmm. And instead, the leading charge of the attack on the wall of separation comes from this completely amoral reality TV figure who was selling meat on television just a few years ago. It boggles the mind.
I mean, Trump vodka.
Yeah, right. You wouldn't believe it if you read it in a work of fiction, yet here we are.
It's true. And as you say, there's that belief among these evangelicals. They finally found the guy who's going to, well, as someone said, I think it might have been Tony Perkins, someone's going to punch the bully. You know, that's we've been waiting for 8 years during the Obama administration. That he was tearing down all these strongholds. Well, and it's going back to that issue of separation of church and state. They see it, I think, as a one-way wall, isn't it? The government shouldn't be overreaching into this sphere of the church, but the church is absolutely it's essential that they get involved in the sphere of the state. What are your thoughts on the future of this whole issue of separation of church and state?
Well, we really are at a very perilous point right now, because so much damage has been done just in 4 short years, and the courts have been stacked with a lot of extremists and so on. And there are some issues that are just slipping away from us, like state funding of religion, taxpayer funding of religion, which used to be unheard of in the United States. Suddenly we're just seeing, you know, more and more of that, and the Supreme Court saying that that type of activity is okay. We're going to have a lot of work to do. I don't know what's going to happen in November. I don't know what the election is going to be, but at some point when the Trump years are over, whether it's in November or 4 years beyond, we're going to just have to start rebuilding that wall, because it will have sustained a lot of damage. I do think, however, that one thing that cuts in our favor are demographic trends in the United States. More and more Americans are saying that they're not really interested in traditional religion anymore. They don't want to belong to a house of worship. It doesn't mean that they're non-believers, although some of them are, but just that they're sort of taking their own path when it comes to spirituality. We can't have that type of freedom and that type of liberty if we don't maintain the wall of separation. So I think people need to make that connection. And if they do, we can get back to that rebuilding that I've been talking about.
It's hugely important. I'm seeing more and more coming around to your point of view for sure, because, you know, like you say, one of your articles, I think, if you look at some of the implications of the 2020 election, you talk about schools and school choice, the school voucher system, the homeschooling movement, religious freedom, whatever that means, as we talk about that, LGBTQ rights, reproductive rights, churches and elections, the whole Johnson Amendment thing, and all these judges that Trump's appointed, a lot of them are lifetime appointees, aren't they? So as you say, even though Trump is going to be gone, hopefully in 2020, but even if he gets another 4 years, these judges are long going to be sitting on the bench, and there's going to be more appointed if he gets another 4 years. So they're not going away.
Yeah, exactly. And unfortunately, I think that will be his legacy. Some of the executive orders that he has signed, those can be done away with the stroke of a pen from another president. The regulatory changes that he has made, those can be overturned and replaced with better regulations. Again, easy to do. But the judges, yeah, their lifetime appointments, they're not going anywhere.
That's a big one. And as you say, the Christian nationalists are absolutely ecstatic. One of the big things, I don't know if you remember that article in Christianity Today that came out, I think it was almost a year ago, year and a half ago, Mark Galli wrote it, and he was the first big name evangelical to speak out against the evangelical support for Trump. And off the back of that article, which caused a firestorm, there was an open letter that about 200, I think it was, evangelical leaders wrote and then signed to say, no, we disagree with Mark Galli. And a lot of those guys were known dominionists. They were some of the names that we've thrown out here. And they said, look, we support Trump because he's given us these judges. You know, we're going to turn this thing around. We're going to overturn Roe versus Wade and all the other laws that have taken our freedoms away. So, yeah, it's hugely important.
It is. Yeah. And that was an interesting situation, because that editor, Christianity Today, was really one of the first voices to say that. Now, he was close to retirement, and he sort of, you know, said that and then exited the stage.
Snuck out the door.
Pretty gutsy, because nobody else was doing that. But unfortunately, it was a little bit of a blip along the way. And I think now we're right back to a lot of these white evangelicals, because, you know, African-American evangelicals aren't in that camp. But
that's
the white evangelicals, the support is still there, because they're seeing the payoff. And it's just, I think, going to continue.
That's 79% to 81%. They're basically still intact from 2016. Trump may go away, but Trumpism will not be gone after he leaves office. The legacy, the ideology is still very much there. These guys aren't going to go away. Well, listen, Rob, I need to let you go. Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time. This is a really important topic for sure. I'm glad that you're raising the awareness and continuing to write and speak out about these really dangerous times that we're living in.
Well, thank you, Clint, for having me on. It was a nice discussion, and I enjoyed the time to talk to you, and hope your listeners find it enlightening.